You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be another adapted OrthoBullets core webinar from the OrthoBullets core curriculum, and this one will cover the topic of articular cartilage defects of the knee. The topic will be reviewed by Dr. Mark Pagnano, who is a joint replacement surgeon and the chairman of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
So articular cartilage defects really do represent a big spectrum. What we really hope to find to be able to treat are the isolated focal defects early in the disease process. Those focal defects in young patients are something that ultimately end up resulting in degenerative arthritis. So we'd like to try to intervene on those early. There are lots of predisposing reasons why people can get these, including ACL tears and the OCD lesions in a small subgroup of patients. I think all of us know that the main problem with articular cartilage is it's a limited ability to spontaneously heal, and the propensity, particularly for lesions above 1 square centimeter, to progress over time and ultimately result in degenerative arthritis. If you look at a microscopic level at the histology of articular cartilage, again, wouldn't spend a ton of time in memorizing these things other than to recognize that the tide mark represents that area that's just above the bone. So that represents the transition zone between cancellous bone to subchondral bone, and then the tide mark is when cartilage takes over. And then degenerative change in the articular cartilage starts from superficial and then goes down to the deep zone and ultimately into the tide mark. So two major classification systems that are really just knockoffs of each other. The outer bridge is most commonly utilized, and I think most of us are familiar with this. Grade 4 representing full thickness articular cartilage loss with exposed subchondral bone. And then for whatever reason, the International Cartilage Repair Society basically decided to do exactly the same thing as the outer bridge and just rename it. So again, I would not waste any time on memorizing the grading other than to recognize that in both grading systems, grade 4 is full thickness articular cartilage loss with exposed subchondral bone. So these are essentially the same ways of describing the anatomy. Articular cartilage defects, again, you want to isolate the difference between asymptomatic defects just found incidentally versus symptomatic defects. You probably only need to be concerned with symptomatic defects. Anytime you're thinking about treatment, you have to put that, again, within this context that the knee should be thought of as an organ. So you need to look at alignment of the extremity, laxity of the joint, so cruciate ligaments and collateral ligament integrity of the meniscus, and whether there's compartment overload. So all of those different aspects, both statically and dynamically, so look at what happens with the patient through the gait cycle as well. The radiographs are used to rule out frank arthritis in the joint and to check the overall knee joint alignment. Semi-flexed or weight-bearing PA flexion views are useful, particularly in looking at the lateral compartment of the knee, in which standing x-rays sometimes underestimate the extent of degenerative arthritis. And finally, particularly for patients in whom you're considering a cartilage regeneration procedure, getting a long leg x-ray is very useful because you do want to understand the mechanical alignment of that limb, because the mechanical axis does have an impact on ultimate success of cartilage interventions. CT scans have a very limited role other than looking at the patellofemoral joint, and my guess is the patellofemoral joint will be looked at in greater detail in another set of lectures. Finally, MRI, particularly today with the use of T2 mapping techniques, is useful in looking both at the extent and breadth of articular cartilage degeneration. So with T2 mapping techniques now, you can actually look at the health of the articular cartilage in different areas in ways that weren't possible before. And this has some major advantages for patients that are undergoing consideration of an articular cartilage procedure. Laboratory tests only have a role in essentially ruling out inflammatory arthritis. Make sure you're not being fooled between osteoarthritis and an inflammatory arthritis. Realistically, the early treatments are very similar to what you'd expect with early degenerative arthritis, so all the same mainline things for osteoarthritis also apply to isolated articular cartilage defects. It's when you get past that initial phase that then we start thinking about other novel techniques. And the novel techniques to regenerate articular cartilage or fix articular cartilage problems are typically follow some algorithm that is primarily driven by age and the size of the defect. And so the younger the patient and the larger the defect, then that pushes you in certain directions. Most people would not do anything for even a full thickness defect that's less than 1 centimeter, 1 square centimeter in size. Some people would extend that up to 2 square centimeters. When you get beyond 2 square centimeters and 4 square centimeters, then you start thinking about these more advanced techniques. Same thing applies to the patellofemoral joint as the tibiofemoral joint. Once you get beyond 4 square centimeters, the algorithm changes and you start to do more invasive or more dramatic types of procedures. So the simple techniques really only apply if you're trying to just help with some simple mechanical symptoms as opposed to a long-term fix. So debriding and doing a chondroplasty, yeah, short-term benefit for those mechanical symptoms if you've got loose fragments, but it's not really going to give you any kind of major long-term benefit. So call a timeout on the didactics and switch to a question here. Patients had a medial femoral condyle OATS procedure. So OATS and mosaicplasty, that applies to an autograft procedure. So which best describes the fixation of the graft? So you have to be thinking this is the patient's own bone and cartilage. What's going to happen with that over time? And the answer on this one is that it's initially put in as a press fit. That press fit is basically going to go away a little bit in the early healing phase as some of the bone starts to actually get slightly resorbed. And then as you actually get subchondral bony healing, then it's going to increase somewhere in the 8 to 12 week time frame. So graft fixation strength initially decreases during early healing, then increases with subchondral bone healing. So again, fixation techniques, this is again kind of jumping back to bigger defects or the OCD defects. And again, I would not spend a ton of time on this. There are a variety of different ways to fix big osteochondral defects, whether they are from osteochondritis desiccans or from a traumatic injury. So whether that's with absorbable or non-absorbable screws or with absorbable pins to fix that. Marrow stimulation techniques are another way to deal with relatively small articular cartilage defects. I think the interest in this has kind of gone through phases. Now it's kind of on the way out, except for the small isolated defects. So it's a reasonable treatment option when you've got a smaller defect, particularly when you find a defect like this incidentally at the time of another procedure. It's at least something that you can add to your armamentarium. It's not a great long-term option in most circumstances. The benefits, it's a simple procedure to do, but again, it does have poor results for the bigger defects. So if you have something between basically 1 square centimeter and 2 square centimeters, then microfracture makes sense. Less than 1 square centimeter, you should probably just do nothing. And beyond 2 square centimeters, you should be thinking of something that's more definitive for addressing that that bigger defect. What's more definitive? Well, osteochondral autograft or osteochondral allograft are reasonable. The autograft, typically termed a mosaicplasty, and that's using a patient's own bone. Obviously, you've got live chondrocytes and you've got live bone that heals reliably. The downside of this is, of course, you have to take good bone and cartilage from one part of the knee and move it to another, so it's limited in what you can do with that. The big study that comes from Europe is from Laszlo Hangodi. He's got the biggest clinical experience in the world, so if you're interested in understanding the ins and outs of mosaicplasty, Hangodi from Hungary is the expert there. He's had more than 30 years of clinical experience with that, and that's a good reference in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. Osteochondral allografts are useful when you get to big defects where the patient's own cartilage is not going to be enough. So once you get up beyond 2 or 3 square centimeters, then it's almost impossible to find enough autograft, and instead you have to go to allograft. So here an allograft procedure is demonstrated. It's got a reasonable track record, but the problem is It is cumbersome and oftentimes time-consuming to try to orchestrate finding an appropriate graft and getting the patient scheduled for surgery. In addition, there are some problems with the grafts themselves in the sense that viable articular cartilage is truly critical to making these things work. And at the present time, none of the donor tissue organizations do anything to actively screen or test the donor tissue for articular cartilage viability on a case-by-case basis. And so that's certainly a limitation in the present setting. We're now approaching 25 years of use with autologous chondrocyte implantation. So ACI does have a clear role still in 2017, particularly for very large defects. So once you get beyond 4 square centimeters, ACI is still something to consider. It really works best when it's just a unipolar lesion, so a lesion typically on the femoral condyle, occasionally on the patella, less commonly on the tibia. There are some patellar unloading procedures that can be done. So if you have patellar defect, historically people have done McKay procedures, a tibiotubical anterization. It's relatively uncommon to do that kind of procedure today. It's useful to recognize that a contraindication is superior patellar arthritis. So if you anteriorize the tibia, you'll preferentially load the superior pole of the patella, and if that's already worn out, then you're going to have a disaster. Similarly, you can consider a Fulkerson. This is most commonly done for the patient that has a combination of a cartilage defect, patellar cartilage defect, or patellofemoral defect, plus a patellar tracking problem. Less commonly done just for a cartilage defect problem. This is moving the tubercle, of course, anterior and medial. Again, has the same contraindication. Because you're moving the anterior, you don't want to have superior patellar arthritis already. Otherwise, you'll make the pain potentially worse for the patient. Finally, there's interest around the rest of the world in taking autologous cultured chondrocytes, mixing them into a matrix, and implanting those. Those matrix or scaffold devices are not currently available for widespread use in the United States. There are a couple of clinical trials at isolated places, but I think not quite ready for prime time in the U.S.
That's all for this review on articular cartilage defects of the knee. If you would like access to the full video version of these core webinars, sign up for the OrthoBullets core curriculum today. There will be a link in the show notes for anyone who is interested. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.